Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Issues in 30 days, issue 24. Do we need a war on terror? After 9/11, the U.S. took a military approach to preventing another attack and redefined the law in the process, from domestic surveillance to the Geneva Conventions. Europe takes a more traditional law enforcement kind of approach to terrorism and shrinks from calling it a war. What would Obama and McCain do? Which one is better? At the Democratic Convention, I got to talk with Senator Obama's chief foreign policy advisor, Susan Rice, and I asked her the question point blank: terror, war, or law enforcement? Do you and Senator Obama accept the war on terror model? Do you accept that term?
The term or the model? What do you mean?
Well, you tell me. How about the model? Well,
not the model. Barack Obama's view is that we have executed the fight against violent extremists very, very poorly, and indeed it's failed. We haven't captured Osama bin Laden. We diverted our effort and attention from al-Qaeda and the Taliban, which are now resurgent in Afghanistan and Pakistan, and went to war in a place that had nothing to do with 9/11. And as a consequence, the Taliban and al-Qaeda are strong and getting stronger.
So,
and every day we see that happening. So it's a failed approach to counterterrorism.
Do you accept the term?
Do I accept the term war on terror? I think it's a poorly chosen term. Terror is not the actor. It's violent extremists who engage in terrorism. But I don't think a semantic debate is the most productive approach to this. The fact we need to have more than a semantic debate.
Right.
We need to have a substantive debate about what the right strategy is.
Well, where it becomes substantive is that Europe, in many cases, takes a more criminal prosecution approach to terrorism rather than a war footing. And there, there are people who write that the United States should do that. Would an Obama administration switch to something like that?
I think that's a very false dichotomy. We need to use military means in certain circumstances to go after terrorists, and Barack Obama has been very clear about that. Indeed, was criticized by John McCain for saying that if we have actionable intelligence about Osama bin Laden or a high-value al-Qaeda target in Pakistan or somewhere else, and the government of that country is unable to act, that we would act.
Susan Rice, chief foreign policy advisor to Barack Obama. I spoke to her at the Democratic National Convention. We will talk to three guests about issue 24, do we need a war on terror, one of the most important issues facing the country. Our first guest is Philip Gurevich, whose latest book is called Standard Operating Procedure, about Abu Ghraib. The movie of the same name is just out from his co-author Errol Morris. The author and filmmaker collaborated on this very unusual joint venture with the book and the movie coming out around the same time. Philip Gurevich, as you may know, is also staff writer for The New Yorker and editor of the Paris Review. Hi, Philip. Welcome back to WNYC.
Good to talk to you, Brian.
So you've said that the infamous mission accomplished speech by President Bush on May 1st, 2003, wasn't just the political blunder we think of it as. He knew there was a lot more fighting to come in Iraq, but he was trying to affect the law. Can you start there?
Yes. Well, under the laws of war, the American military doctrine, and the Geneva Conventions, essentially, there is one idea of a war, a conventional war, which is defined as a war between two sovereign powers. And you're actually fighting your army is fighting the army of a constituted national government. So that was the war we had against Saddam Hussein in the months immediately following the invasion of Iraq and the conquest of Baghdad. As long as we were fighting Saddam Hussein's army, this was a war that fell under the Geneva Conventions completely. We took prisoners, and we called them prisoners of war, POWs. We released them following the mission accomplished speech, which is what you're supposed to do, according to U.S. military doctrine. And then, of course, we were still taking prisoners, and we were fighting a mounting insurgency. And the idea was that a kind of legal pivot took place at that moment. The declaration that major combat was over was not a declaration that the war was over. It was a folding of the Iraq war into the context of this what the administration people sometimes call the long war, the global war on terror, the GWOT, as they like to refer to it.
GWOT, GWOT.
GWOT, and they actually pronounce it GWOT, an unfortunate acronym. And the idea being that suddenly anybody that we were arresting was now a illegal combatant, unaffiliated with a legitimate government, and therefore a criminal rather than a soldier, therefore can be covered under ideas of what a terrorist is treated as. And there's some real dispute was going on inside the administration, even as they said, oh, all the laws of Geneva and of American doctrine apply in Iraq. They were making exceptions for all of these people whom they reclassified as security detainees.
Right, so they were spreading the fog of war to the law. And I wonder if you think
they were using the law from the very beginning to institute a fog in this war and to change American military doctrine and American principles that had stood in place since revolutionary days.
For you, does that fit into the larger idea of a war on terror, a GWOT, as opposed to Europe's more law enforcement approach, into that dichotomy that I was talking to Susan Rice about that she didn't quite want to accept?
Yeah, I actually agree with Susan Rice that it's not an entirely useful dichotomy, which is to say I don't think there's anybody on either side of certainly the political presidential campaign at this point who would say that we don't need a military response to certain kinds of terrorism. We only need a law enforcement response. But I think that what you see is the model of the war on terror is that we fight them in some ways the way they fight us. That's the real problem with it. It's that we have used their tactics and their strategies as the measure of it. And in this sense, the Bush administration, and by every indication, McCain policy, which comes right out of it, seeks to or plays into the hands of al-Qaeda. I mean, it's not coincidental that, as the Washington Post reported yesterday, al-Qaeda is coming out saying McCain would continue Bush's losing strategies and therefore continue to strengthen al-Qaeda. At every step, we have made Osama bin Laden and al-Qaeda our big enemy. We've elevated them. We've served as a great recruiting tool. We've walked right into the battlefields that they whistled and beckoned us to come and fight on and fought in the same way that they've wanted. And I think the bigger failure and the bigger, more important dichotomy is that a war on terror has to be fought not only as a military campaign or a law enforcement campaign, but also as a worldwide struggle for global public opinion. And that is something we've botched terribly, and I think that I'd like to be hearing a lot more from both candidates about how they're going to, in a sense, restore the idea that we stand for something completely different.
Since Guantanamo is such a symbol of that, I asked Susan Rice also about Guantanamo Bay and about Salam Hamdan, Osama bin Laden's driver, who was convicted at Gitmo and whose sentence will actually end soon. Let's hear that exchange.
It's clear we need to close Guantanamo, and Barack Obama has been very clear about his commitment to do so. How we then deal with each of those individual detainees is a very complicated question. And it's not one that is wise to speculate on in the context of a campaign. Some of these individuals will need to be treated in different ways than others.
Would he release Salam Hamdan since his sentence would be up?
I'm not in a position to comment on that.
Again, Barack Obama's chief foreign policy advisor, Susan Rice, with me at the Democratic Convention. Philip Gurevich, any reaction to that? Both candidates say close Gitmo. She wouldn't take a position on whether serving your full sentence means you get released under these new Bush interpretations of the law.
Well, I think in the context of the campaign, they're going to be very, very careful, the Democrats, about not looking, quote-unquote, weak on national security, which is one of the reasons, and they're going to be very careful about the fact that the whole legal context that's created the mess at Guantanamo, everybody agrees it's a catastrophe. Nobody's clear how to solve it. How do you release people? What's the public relations basis for that? And so they're all going to play it very safe going into it. But I think the other really important thing to be concerned about is that, yes, both candidates are for closing Guantanamo. Both say that they oppose torture in various ways, although John McCain has signed on to waterboarding, which is torture. The legal reasoning that the Bush administration used as they brought these previously illegal tactics into a kind of legally authorized and legitimated American policy always was wrapped up in a big concept of a super powerful executive during wartime, a president who's almost virtually unchecked by law. And extricating these licenses that have been created from that executive power is not so easy. And what I think is very hard is to find a presidential candidate who's going to run on a platform of clipping his own wings. And I think that's going to be the hardest thing for any of them. They may say, I won't use those powers, but are they going to roll them back? Are they going to put them back where they were before and make it harder for those things ever to happen again? Because we now have crossed a lot of lines that one has to uncross.
And neither of them are explicitly promising to give away the new executive powers that, that Bush accumulated.
No, I mean, it's quite striking that, for instance, Barack Obama, in the primary period, opposed warrantless wiretapping. And when he became the candidate and it was up for renewal, he voted in favor of it. Now, Hillary Clinton did the opposite. Hillary Clinton was always for warrantless wiretapping, and of course Hillary Clinton thought she would be occupying an executive office in the near future. And when it became clear that she was going to be back in the legislature, she was for a strong legislature and for opposing warrantless wiretapping. But it's striking that it was not something that, as he started to face the prospect of his own executive power, Obama was ready to give up. And I think we just have to watch for those sorts of things, because in the context of this war on terror, to the extent that we use terror to fight terror, we've been handing the enemy a victory, and we have not been making ourselves more secure. These things are always pitched as a national security thing, but when we legalize torture, when we make extraordinary rendition and holding people without trial and without charges and without evidence, national policy, I think we have to understand that that actually compromises our national security, and that our security will depend on that recognition in the next administration.
Philip Gurevich, before you go, your new book and Errol Morris's new movie are standard operating procedure. They're out at the same time. What a fascinating thing. Just tell us, how much of a collaboration was it, and did you have a model for this kind of book-documentary joint venture? Did anybody do this before who inspired you?
As far as we know, no, because they really are also, they're very closely related in the sense that Errol had been interviewing many of the American soldiers who appeared in and took the photographs or just served at the time that the photographs were being taken at Abu Ghraib prison. And as he collected these interviews, he started sending them to me, and I started joining him for the interviews. And I made a book based on the same sort of archive of documentary information that he had accumulated from which he made the film, but they are not the book of the film or the film of the book, and as far as I know, that's unique, and what I really drew on were these extraordinary accounts by these soldiers, who are the only ones who, by the way, have ever served prison sentences, who were the lowest soldiers in rank and found themselves executing a policy that they didn't even really fully understand was a policy until after the fact.
Philip Gurevich, staff writer at The New Yorker, editor of the Paris Review, and author now of Standard Operating Procedure. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Brian.
30 issues in 30 days, issue 24. Do we need a war on terror? More in a minute. Our next 30 Issues Wiki is now active at WNYC.org. It's for tomorrow's program on arts and culture policy. If you haven't used a wiki before, it's not just a comments page. It's a way for you to collaborate with each other to help produce our series, suggest guests and questions and audio clips, even the words that come out of my mouth. That's a very active wiki we've got going on arts and culture and the presidential candidates. So check out and contribute to the 30 Issues Wiki at WNYC.org/30issues. This is 30 Issues in 30 Days, issue 24. Do we need a war on terror?
But I can tell you that I think America is safer today than it was in 9/11. But that doesn't mean that we don't have a long way to go.
Well, first of all, I think that we are safer in some ways. Obviously, we've poured billions of dollars into airport security. We have done some work in terms of securing potential targets, but we still have a long way to go.
So we have a long way to go in our intelligence services. We have to do a better job in human intelligence, and we've got to make sure that we have people who are trained interrogators so that we don't ever torture a prisoner ever again.
We've got to make sure that we're hardening our chemical sites. We haven't done enough in terms of transit. We haven't done enough in terms of ports.
We have to make sure that our technological and intelligence capabilities are better. We have to work more closely with our allies. I know our allies, and I can work much more closely with them.
And the biggest threat that we face right now is not a nuclear missile coming over the skies. It's in a suitcase.
Obama and McCain, from their first debate last month, both working the theme of more to be done, sounding very much the same there on making America safe. But how similar are they? Roxana Tiran of the Capitol Hill newspaper The Hill has done a point-by-point comparison of the Obama and McCain positions on this. She did it for Popular Mechanics and their series Geek the Vote, and she joins us now. Hi, Roxana. Welcome to WNYC.
Hi, good to be with you.
One of your comparisons is called Overall Strategy, Offense versus Defense. Do you see one as more on offense, one more on defense?
Definitely, yes. I think that's going to determine how much, you know, how much money an Obama or a McCain administration will have for homeland security and for national security. And I think they approach it in quite different ways. I think McCain thinks that we need to fight terrorists in their home or in their countries or in their camps, and Obama thinks that we need to protect ourselves at home, which means pulling out troops from Iraq, I guess, which would save a lot of money, in his opinion, and putting it into infrastructure, into high tech, into more people to make sure that that the country is safe, versus McCain, who wants to fight them, outside of the country.
Right, and they do seem to disagree on where the central front in the war on terror is. They both use that expression, and in terms of being overseas, McCain obviously sees it as being in Iraq. Obama sees it as being in Afghanistan, and I guess that has financial consequences for how they fund anti-terror efforts at home, because it's just much cheaper what we're doing in Afghanistan.
That's correct. But I think also, I think for a long time, McCain was thinking that Iraq is the sort of the center of it all. But I think now more and more he's starting to, and I think it was pretty obvious in the last few weeks, that he's really starting to realize that the border between Afghanistan and Pakistan is a real problem as well. How he connects that to Iraq, I think it's a different
right.
story. But I think you're going to see this rhetoric of taking troops out of Iraq and putting more of them in Afghanistan. You're going to see increased costs for doing that. It doesn't come cheap. So I think somebody like Obama and McCain, who's probably going to want more troops in Afghanistan as well, I think they're going to have to balance that balance is going to be quite interesting. How they're going to find the money to do that and then do the things that they were promising, to do at home.
Well, the clips we played included various defenses that they believe need to be strengthened at home. Just in the at-home, homeland security, do you think they differ on where to focus?
No, I actually don't think so. I think they're close. I think what the difference is how they would approach it. For example, I think the Department of Homeland Security is going to be a serious issue for both of them. They're going to have to tackle that department, because right now it's just a bureaucracy and it's just a completely unwieldy department. And I think they're going to have to go through a quadrennial homeland security review, which Congress has mandated, and they're going to have to analyze how to best streamline that agency. Because right now, I think, the way it is, they're both recognizing that it needs significant changes. And I think how they're going to go about that is where they're going to put their resources. In terms of, I think they're both agreeing on the fact that we need strengthened port security, we need high tech for monitoring systems. They both agree that cybersecurity is important, but I think they have a different approach on that as well. Obama, for example, wants to have a national advisor who would report directly to him on cybersecurity and cyber threats.
Now, let's talk about that for a minute, because I'm glad you included it, and it's relevant and appropriate that since you're writing as part of the Geek the Vote series for Popular Mechanics, that you include cybersecurity. But what is cybersecurity?
I just think that it's one of those issues that is gonna completely come to the forefront in you know maybe next year, or it's something that has not gotten so much play, I think, but it's getting more and more important as the as more people have access to technology. We're talking about simply like breaking into computer systems, hacking into secure systems that we've already seen with the Pentagon being hacked into the systems. I think you can completely disrupt everything depends on technology. Everything in the U.S. military and Homeland Security depends on technology, communication, technology, like unmanned systems. Everything has a technology backbone, and if you're able to disrupt that, you're basically able to disrupt the entire process there. And I think that's what people at the Pentagon are concerned, and they're really working towards trying to make those their systems and their computer systems and communication systems more secure. And they're realizing that cyber threat is growing. It's not something, because people are getting more adept at knowing how to do that, and it's something that they constantly need to adjust. So it's going to be a really hard job for them to do. But it's one of the more important issues, I think, that the Pentagon is dealing with, and I guess the intelligence agencies as well. That's going to come to the forefront sooner than later.
Another disagreement that you point out in your article is what they would do with FEMA, the Federal Emergency Management Agency, which of course appeared to fail so badly during Hurricane Katrina. How would they each deal with FEMA?
Well, Obama, for example, wants to take FEMA out of the Department of Homeland Security. It's FEMA was a separate agency before, but it was lumped into DHS. McCain doesn't want to take it out of DHS. What he wants is FEMA to rely on private enterprises that have experience with distributing goods, services, and supplies. So sort of privatize FEMA in a way, or have a public-private partnership with that.
Why? What are the pros and cons of each?
To be honest with you, I think what has been very clear is that FEMA just didn't have the ability to handle, for particularly Hurricane Katrina. I think you've seen with the hurricanes this year, it's gotten a little bit better. I think what Obama wants is to have somebody, the FEMA director, be completely depoliticized, and it should be somebody from the professional force, an expert, and that obviously has its advantages, because then you have somebody who knows how to handle this, somebody with experience, somebody who doesn't depend on, I have to be responsive to administration rather than doing the right thing, which I think we have seen as well. And then on the other hand, having the public-private enterprise is, relying on companies or relying on entities that have had experience, sort of in the commercial business. You've seen companies are extremely efficient, so it's trying to get, to get that efficiency into the government as well. So I think perhaps a combination of the two.
Right. Has either of them said who they might appoint for Homeland Security Secretary to succeed Michael Chertoff?
No, no, they haven't. They haven't been very specific about their cabinet appointments.
I've heard rumors of Joe Lieberman, who I think was the one who first introduced the idea of a Homeland Security Department and maybe a 9/11 commission, back when he was a Democrat, that he actually might be John McCain's Homeland Security chief, but you haven't seen any evidence of that.
No, but it's very possible. It's very possible if McCain wins.
Did you look into the question that we started the hour with of whether Obama goes so far as to accept the European model of seeing terrorism as a crime rather than an act of war and fighting it like we fight other crimes?
I have personally not looked into that issue, so I would not be able to comment
on
that.
So last thing, President Bush was opposed to even having a 9/11 commission or a Department of Homeland Security originally. Obama wasn't in the Senate yet, but McCain was. And I know you compared them on the recommendations of the September 11th commission. Are they different at this point?
No, I think they both agree on that, and I think Obama, after he got in the Senate, I think he definitely supports the commission and its recommendation,
but
so does McCain.
In terms of what's left to do there.
Exactly. Yeah. And I mean, McCain was one of the brain trust behind creating that commission. So.
All right. Roxana Tirado of the Capitol Hill newspaper, The Hill. She has done a point-by-point comparison of the Obama and McCain positions on counterterrorism for the Geek the Vote series of Popular Mechanics. Thanks a lot, Roxana.
Thank you.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. More to come with the Deputy Commissioner of the NYPD. A lot of people say Ray Kelly and his people do counterterrorism a lot better than they do in Washington, and we'll get a New York perspective on this. Stay tuned.
In the meantime, Bin Laden is still out there. He is not captured. He is not killed. Al-Qaeda is resurgent.
Obama from the first debate last month. This is 30 Issues in 30 Days, Issue 24. Do we need a war on terror? And to finish up, well, many experts in this field think the NYPD and Police Commissioner Ray Kelly do a generally better job than people at the Department of Homeland Security. So let's have a short conversation with Richard Falkenrath. He's the Deputy Commissioner for Counterterrorism. He's the top counterterrorism official at the NYPD. Deputy Commissioner Falkenrath, thanks so much for coming on WNYC with us.
Happy to be here, Brian.
Is there an NYPD approach to keeping the city safe that you think is any different from the federal Homeland Security approach, or that you'd characterize in a general way?
Well, we do certainly have an approach to protecting the city that is different from the federal government, but it's also complementary to the federal efforts. And we are here on the ground in a way that the federal government is not, and work every day 24/7 to provide the best protection of the city that we can. Our approach is comprehensive. We do many things in cooperation with other agencies, including the federal government, but we also do many things independently and on our own. The program has been widely recognized as one of the foremost counterterrorism programs in the world, and I think the reputation is well deserved.
Obviously, I don't want you to give away anything, you know, that's a secret that helps us stop the bad guys, but what would you say is at the heart of it?
Well, I think there's a couple parts there's two aspects that are the most important. I think the first is a very comprehensive effort to prevent attacks by penetrating plots. And we do this, as I said, both cooperatively with the federal government, in particular the FBI, and then separately through the NYPD Intelligence Division. The other half is an effort to provide security on the ground every day. And if you live in New York City, you will have undoubtedly seen the NYPD officers deployed on the street in a counterterrorism capacity. You will very rarely see such deployments elsewhere in the country, and we do it to provide a direct protection of the areas of the city that are most at risk of being attacked by terrorists.
On that point, I know you're very much for the so-called Ring of Steel, a massive presence of surveillance cameras for Lower Manhattan. And I'm curious, why Lower Manhattan? They already destroyed the World Trade Center. Why think that's the overwhelming focus of their targeting for the future?
Well, we are rebuilding the World Trade Center. It's been attacked twice already, and it has a very special place in Al-Qaeda mythology and ideology. We expect, unfortunately, that it will continue to figure very high in the possible targets of terrorist attacks. And our interest is to deter such attacks, to make sure that does not happen again. But in addition to the World Trade Center, Lower Manhattan has the densest concentration of critical infrastructure and high-priority targets, I think, anywhere in the country. It's a very small area, but it's economically vital, and it's extremely dense with transportation infrastructure, the financial community, of course, many high-rises, a number of important telecommunications facilities. It is a special district, and consequently, we've given it special attention.
You know, there was a scary op-ed piece in the Daily News yesterday, maybe you saw it, by former New York City Police Commissioner William Bratton, saying Bin Laden wants a vote in this election and may well try a repeat of something like what Al-Qaeda did in Madrid just before the elections in Spain a few years ago. Are you concerned about that for New York?
Well, we're concerned about an attack all the time. And I think it is certainly true that in the past, Al-Qaeda has attempted to influence democratic elections. But there is no specific or credible indication that that's about to happen in this case.
Bratton also says that state and local police should be extra vigilant guarding high-value financial targets in particular. He says harming our financial system while it's down right now would be right up bin Laden's M.O. Are you working on that same assumption?
Well, we provide that vigilance to the financial targets every day. We did that before the election season, and we're doing it during the election season. We've always thought the financial community was a potential target. While it may be true that it's particularly susceptible to the repercussions, economic repercussions of an attack, we bring the same vigilance to the financial community today that we did a year ago and 3 years before that.
In our last minute, what would New York want from the next president, whoever it is, on homeland security?
I think we will want continued efforts to take the fight to the enemy, to make sure that when there are foreign terrorists abroad trying to hatch plots against the United States, that we are unremitting in our efforts to stop them. At home, we're going to be looking at the funding effort. Does the federal government maintain and increase its commitment to the local security efforts that we've put in place? And frankly, we've had a lot of problems with the federal government to get them directing the resources where the risk is highest. The natural tendency of the federal government is to spread the money evenly around the country so everyone's a little bit happy. New York has been consistent in saying, no, the threat is not even. The money has to follow the threat, and the threat is predominantly in the major metro areas.
10 seconds. I think I've heard both Obama and McCain articulate that principle. Would you say?
I don't know. We haven't really been following the election that closely on these issues, and we'll see what they do, whoever wins, when they're in office.
Deputy Commissioner for Counterterrorism at the NYPD, Richard Falkenrath, thanks so much. We really appreciate it.
You're welcome, Brian.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC, Leonard Lopate coming up right after the news with lots of dance talk today, paying tribute to the late Anthony Tudor, then groundbreaking choreographer Christopher Wilden will be here and more with Leonard coming up after the news. This is WNYC.